Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast is Sister Al Caraway. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, I am so excited.
And I'm going to probably call you Al sometimes and Sister Caraway, but we're so grateful. And you are, I'm calling you, and where are you right now, Al?
I'm in upstate New York.
Okay, so this is over the phone, and we think the quality will be good. We offered a prayer before we started, and what I want to accomplish in this podcast is for Al to share her conversion story. It's a remarkable conversion story, and it led to a couple books. Tattooed Mormon, that was the first time you really got on my radar map with that awesome book. You've written another book called Cheers to Eternity, and that would be another book to discuss. And I understand you're working on a third book. And
Yes, a surprise.
And you go all across the country to speak at firesides and stakes, and you're helping so many of our members. So thank you for being on the podcast. And you've got, tell us your family situation. Are you married? I know you're married.
I'm married, and I have two kids. They're going to be 3 and 5, and they are so funny. I like them. And having kids is way better than I thought it would be.
And that's awesome. Way to go. And we, before we started, Al mentioned she was eating Captain Crunch cereal, and that reminds me of my days when I would eat the kids' cereal. So I don't know if that's your cereal, Al, or your kids' cereal.
Depends who you ask. If you ask my kids, it's theirs, but it's just, it's, we don't talk about it.
I'm addicted to Cheerios. Anyway, will you tell us where you grew up and just how you found the church and your journey into the church?
Yeah, so I actually grew up here in upstate New York. So I was born and raised and stayed until I was about 21. And it wasn't until I was about to turn 21 that I just met the doofiest boys you ever could picture, who ended up being missionaries. And I was helping someone move, and they knew who they were, and I didn't, but they were so mean to them, and I felt bad because they're precious looking. So I told them I'd listen if they brought me a steak. This is like the classic story. And they did. They brought me a steak that same day. So it all started out of obligation. Now, where I'm from, culture is very diverse, very different. Just really East Coast in general, but especially New York. It's like, you don't need help from anyone or anything, definitely not religion. And you grow up, I mean, in kindergarten even, you're never asked about starting a family and getting married and having kids. It's all career oriented. And it's just like kindergarten, what are you going to do when you grow up, you know? And this is like the question you're asked, but your quest is not after family or any of those things. It's after success and being able to protect and take care of yourself. And so this is kind of like my background and my mentality. We're all super stubborn out here.
Awesome.
We're all very blunt.
Good.
And so that's kind of me beforehand. And so I'm trying to tell these boys, like, all of these blessings you're working towards, like, they're all in your head. So in my mind, the only way that I could prove them wrong was to live how they were teaching me to the best that I could, and to live it long enough to allow contrast to happen, if it were to happen, and then go back to them and be like, see, I told you. And then, you know, the funny thing is about trying, and the funny thing about living the gospel is, you know, you get blessings and you change. And so, joke's on me, because I got baptized.
How long was it from when you, that steak dinner to when you were baptized?
How long did it feel like? How long was it actually? Start of summer, and then I just got baptized in August, but man, the stuff that you have to change. I mean, people don't realize that getting baptized is the most personal and difficult thing we could ever ask of anyone, because you do have to change and rethink, you know, years and years, in this case, 21 years of culture and tradition and knowledge. And, you know, not even what you do has to be different, but even the way that you think, you know, is now different. And so you really are just changing everything there was. I mean, 21 years worth of stuff. And so those were a brutal, you know, three-ish, whatever month. But I mean, I guess that was really all it was.
That's really honest. Do you remember, if I go back to your baptism day, tell us your baptism day. Do you know it off the top of your head?
Yeah, August 22nd. It's also my wedding date 4 years
wow.
later.
Wow. This is a big day, August 22nd. What a great... And if I had met you on August 22nd, your baptism day, and I said, Sister Caraway, what were kind of the main doctrines that kind of drew you or teachings that drew you to the church that were are central to you? What would you say? Do you remember? Or what would you say now?
Well, I'm here up in about 20 minutes from Palmyra. So one of the first few things I've ever learned about or the biggest focus was on was Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. And having got baptized, there is so much I had no idea about. There's just so much you don't know about. And, you know, I knew the Book of Mormon was true, but I didn't even read it all the way through. I don't think I made it past a few chapters until I knew it made everything true. And that's not naive of me. That's just what the Spirit does. And so you gain a testimony that you know enough to move forward. And then you learn and you gain smaller testimonies as you go about, you know, these other principles and whatever, whatever. And so really, like, I love Joseph Smith. Oh, my gosh. I just love him.
That's
I love everything
cool.
about him.
That's cool. And that's where my testimony is, too, is around the Book of Mormon and the truthfulness of that and the restoration. Other thoughts?
No, I mean, that was really that it was... because... I'm sure this might have been your next question, but I mean, I got baptized and I'm thinking, wow, if I thought life was like pretty good before I got baptized, when I was God, like I am unstoppable. And then I got baptized.
That's great.
And then my life fell apart.
Tell us about
and
that.
And most times, the only thing I felt like I did have were my scriptures. All of my friends, they wanted nothing to do with me and what I was a part of. And my dad, you know, oh my gosh, the closest we could ever imagine. I saw him every day. I would tell him everything. And I didn't hear from him for years. I mean, he made me pick, and that's not really in his character to have made me do that, but I don't think he thought I wouldn't have picked him.
Uh-huh.
And then I think when I didn't, it hurt him enough to drive him away and
wow.
keep his end of the, you know, deal. And I didn't hear from him. I didn't hear from most of my family for a while.
Wow.
And it was brutal.
Wow.
I mean, I just remember thinking, man, I feel like I'm being punished for doing what I thought was the right thing. And, you know, this isn't what the missionary taught me it would do. And, you know, my dad, he says, you know, this church who, you know, I just found out about, you know, not too long ago, you know, it's tearing our family apart. And it's like, man, what happened? I thought I was doing it. I thought, you know, this is where it got better. And it wasn't. I mean, I didn't know loneliness until I joined the church, and I didn't know judgment. Mostly coming from New York, you know, of all places, you know, until I joined the church, I didn't know, you know, all of these things until, yeah, I decided to get baptized.
Thanks for being so honest, Al. I think that helps other people that just think everything's going to be hunky-dory. And it sounds
it was far from hunky-dory
for you. And how did you navigate that? I love you said I turned to the scriptures. How did you... What else did you do to sort of hang in there during this really tender time?
Well, like I said, I mean, I was starting from scratch. I really did have to guess my way through everything. I didn't even know if I was praying, right? Like, I didn't have a support team to tell me this is how you do it. You will never hear me say nourish and strengthen in a prayer because that's not how I learned to talk to God. I learned to talk to him by saying, what is going on? I don't like this. This doesn't make sense. And I learned that through those honest pleadings and my really vulnerable experiments through trying to figure this out completely by myself, that I was able to get to a point to keep going the next time things were hard or didn't make sense. And so it was a lot of experimenting, and it was a lot of hope at first that God really is as good as I was told he was. And so it took one time, and unfortunately right out of the gate it was like the hardest one. But it takes, you know, sometimes it just takes one time to allow ourselves to give God the opportunity to be God. And that's hard for us to do.
Wow, I love that.
But are we allowing ourselves to give him the opportunity to show us how great he really is? And I knew that if I was ever going to learn, is God really good? Now's the time for him to show me, like, this is it. And so, I mean, just like gaining the testimony, I was going to keep going, and I was going to keep going long enough to allow change to happen if it were to happen. And I was going to keep going long enough to allow blessings to blossom if they were to blossom. And I mean, it was a while. I mean, depending on what we'd ask about, like, oh, well, what about your dad? Well, that was something, you know, that's still in like the making sometimes, but other things come together. And I do believe that if we just walk on those unexpected and unwanted and uncharted paths, we do see that things are better than what we had in mind. Even if sometimes those uncharted and unwanted paths are longer than anticipated.
Well, this is really touching, Al, because I know as a missionary we would promise blessings that you've realized and have seen, but at first it sounds like it was very difficult, and I admire you hanging in there, and it sounds like you went deep with your relationship with God and through the scriptures and prayer. Did this end, this phase of kind of unsettledness ever end, or did it gradually end, or was there...
No.
Is it just kind of a journey?
So my next step was, instead of thinking about the things that were falling apart and things that were going wrong, I decided to focus on God and what I thought he wanted me to do. So it was a really big mental shift. And I wanted to go on a mission so bad. I mean, the only people I had were missionaries. I'm like, this is it. It's what I wanted. This is what I'm doing. And I knew my answer was going to be yes. And it wasn't. It was moved to Utah. And it was as if I couldn't devastate my family anymore. I did.
Wow.
And it was as if God couldn't pull me away from my family anymore. It happened. Because now I'm driving across the country by myself in my two-door Bolero Oldsmobile with my dog, with nothing else except what could fit in a two-door car made in the 90s.
Wow.
And although it was the most difficult thing, you know, leaving my family, having to cope with the idea that I could maybe never see my dad again, you know, leaving, you know, and even though that was so hard, and God didn't even tell me why, which I think was the worst part, is I didn't even know why I was doing it. It was like a glimmer of hope that maybe this is where things come together. Maybe this is where things make sense and things will become easy. The blessings will start to come. And I got there, and that was shattered pretty quickly as things got a lot worse.
Wow.
And that was months and months of me trying to figure out, wait, what am I going to do about this? What am I going to do about God still not answering me, just the why behind it all, let alone everything else. And, you know, here I was thinking it was going to get better. And with passing time, it really only got worse. Except this time I'm across the country and I don't know anyone. And I've never been there before. And that was new and hard. But you just, I mean, whatever. You're going to choose God or you're not. I mean, that's what it comes down to. That's what everything comes down to. Are you going to choose Him or you aren't? So I decided once again, and, you know, sometimes I have to make that decision several times a day, is, well, wait. I went 21 years not thinking God was real. And when I got confirmed and I got the gift of the Holy Ghost, there was a physical contrast. So no matter how tempting it is to do this all too familiar dance with the adversary, where you get angry and you get offended either by God or by others, no pathetic attempt from the adversary really can take away from the reality of what I did feel when I got confirmed. And so I held on to that, and I'm like, wait, He showed me He was there before. He's got to do it again at some point. So I chose Him. I chose Him again. And like I said, sometimes I had to do that several times a day to keep going, but that's what I did.
That's really cool. I love the way you reflected back to the experience of getting the Holy Ghost and held on to that. That's very courageous. Keep sharing. I love hearing this, Al. So you're here in Utah and things are even harder. Tell us more.
It's hard. How do you explain a different culture? I lived in Utah for 9 years and I love it. You adjust to it. You don't even blink towards most things anymore. And it wasn't until I moved back last year that I'm like, oh, you know, it is a different. And it's not just Utah's different. I mean, East Coast, West Coast even is so different. But I mean, you see everything in New York. Everyone is, for the most part, it's dangerous to speak in generalities, but to be general, everyone feels comfortable with themselves out here because no one cares. You just do whatever you want. Like, it's fine. And for the first time in my life, I felt very uncomfortable with myself.
Wow.
After 21 years of confidence and stubbornness, and I all of a sudden didn't feel like I had strength to go to the grocery store because I just couldn't handle one more day of people staring.
Wow.
I didn't know how to handle that. That was something I've never dealt with before. It's completely foreign to me. I all of a sudden had guys my age looking for temple-worthy girls that not only do I not exactly look temple-worthy, and not only did they not want to date me, they didn't even speak to me. I don't know. Maybe they thought, well, we don't know what's going on with her, so maybe it's best that we just stay away. I don't know what it was. But then this loneliness is almost indescribable. And like I said, it really just turned back to, okay, what did the missionaries teach me? Because that's all I have right now. I didn't have anyone's testimonies to lean on. I didn't have any primary songs or, you know, whatever to reflect on or buoy me up. It's like, wait, where are the pamphlets? What does that say?
That's so honest. And I'm trying to imagine the visual of you going to a grocery store and somebody just giving you, you know, a look you felt and a look of judgment. And here you are.
Oh, it's like lasers.
And I assume we're talking about your beautiful tats.
Yeah. I mean, my very first day in Utah. I mean, it's summertime. I'm standing in line at Cafe Rio and I'm holding a church book. It's all I read. It's a biography. I don't know. One of the prophets. And the first thing someone said to me when I moved there, after giving up my family and everything, the guy says, pretty ironic looking the way you do holding that book.
Oh, my God.
And it was in that moment that my heart just shattered. It's like, wait, what do you do with this? You know, in New York, in other places, or maybe just my single ward branch in New York. I mean, you hear ward family. That is literal. I mean, that's just who you have. And I was so excited to be completely surrounded by that. But then it was who I thought my brothers and sisters would be were the ones treating me this way.
I'm just so sorry.
And like I said, I mean,
it's so painful. Did you come close to leaving the? Did you come close to saying, "I've done the best I can. This church just isn't for me"?
No.
Wow.
No, I never thought about quitting in the sense of quitting the church, but I did have thoughts of, well, why don't I just go back where things made sense and where things were comfortable? Or, you know, I have things that would stop me. I mean, the first thing I know about the adversary, he just stops you from doing what you're supposed to do. And sometimes it's not about doing bad things, sometimes just standing still. And when I realized, like, all I wanted to do was stay in the house when I first moved there, I realized, wait, that's not God. And so it was easier to navigate that way. And so really the whole time through struggling, it was me trying to figure out, how am I going to be productive with this? Because I didn't just sacrifice all that and go out there to stop.
That's cool. That is really cool. How am I going to be productive? What am I learning from this? And here you are wanting this family, this ward family, to be duplicated on a much grander scale and following God's impressions to Utah. And it's sort of like, that, I can see you in that Cafe Rio line, Al. I can somehow just see that long line, maybe 20 people ahead of you, and you're, wow. You know, I think one of the things I love about your story is you've had difficult parts of your journey into the church and you've stayed. And I think it gives, as you know, in all your speaking and writing, it gives people perspective and principles to say, well, if Al can stay, she's gone through some pretty difficult stuff, then maybe I can follow her example and stay close to God and remember the feelings I felt and stay and recognize there's a difference between our church and our
people are like, oh, I thought I had it bad. And then I heard your story. And I'm like, well, you're welcome.
So tell us,
I don't know, but...
I'm remembering of in our YSA ward, a young man who joined the church with tats. He had 26 or 27. We talked, and his last tat was his day of his baptism, but he went and did baptisms for the dead. And he told me, he said, Bishop, some of the sisters there mean mugged me. And, you know, they gave him the same look you've been given. And it was difficult for him, but like you, he had a deep enough testimony to sort of navigate that. And, you know, but it was painful for him to be mean mugged on his first day in a temple, as some of the temple workers sort of gave him the look and made him feel not worthy. Talk about, you know, this book. So that could be a long...
The lasers is what I call it. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like when you are in such a high population of members, people who have tattoos or look different, it, to me, in my situation, people didn't look at me, and the thought never crossed people's mind is, oh, she's a convert, or, oh, she's not even part of our religion. People would look at me, and they tend to look at people that are different and say, oh, they grew up in this church, and they are actively going against my God who I love, and so they're offended, and they're in protection mode. And so it's just kind of interesting that I noticed that there is no, it's just the go-to thought is, oh, they were raised in the church and they're doing things that they taught not to. They must hate my God who I love. And so I have to realize, like, you know, instead of getting mad and hurt, I try not to use the word offended because I feel like it takes the blame off the person who should be blamed. I say hurt.
Yeah.
You know, I instead of feeling those things, because those can be all-consuming things, that, well, I just decided to look at it differently. I always feel like there's a different way to look at it. And so I'm like, well, maybe they just haven't learned that lesson yet. You know, maybe I can't get mad at them if they hadn't learned that yet. And maybe I could be the one to teach them. And like I said, that was a long process. I mean, when I first got there and I was still trying to figure out, wait, how do I do this? You know, I would go to the store and we have, what, 105 degree summers. And I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt until I figured out how I was going to react and how I was going to try and teach and cope, or maybe get to a point where I don't even notice it anymore. And so that was a one-on-one thing with God. And really what it came down to is believing how God sees me is true. And I needed to feel that. And those took some really long looks in the mirror and a lot of priesthood blessing and a lot of, you know, that intimate one-on-one time to get to that point. So one of my priesthood blessings, I mean, they said it's completely irrelevant to this specific situation. I just got in one and it just happened to mention this. But he says, God does not see any of your tattoos. To him, they are completely gone. And I think that's a part of the atonement that we don't fully understand. That sometimes we think that we do something wrong and he forgives us and he chooses to look past it. When in reality, it's like they just don't exist. And when I heard that he doesn't see them, and if he doesn't care, then I don't care. And if I don't care, then anyone can look at me however they want, and I just don't care.
That's cool.
The point where I got to.
That's really cool. I love that in the moment of hurt, and I think hurt's a primary human emotion that we need to honor in ourselves, you were reflective enough, and maybe it didn't come day one in the Cafe Rio line, but you were reflective enough to say, what's going on with them to cause them to say that? Because you gave them the benefit of the doubt, Al, that they were a good person and that they wanted to do the right thing. And so you were thoughtful enough to sort of understand what would cause them to say that. And it's a great sign of, I think, of maturity. And I realize it may not have come day one in the Cafe Rio line when you're really hurt. But to get to that point is very, very thoughtful. Tell us about the book. So I don't know how many years you're in Utah. I don't know where the idea first came to write a book. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
So it all started within that first year of Utah. I realized something ignorant about myself. And that is, it never occurred to me that people had the gospel and didn't do anything about it. It rocked my world. And I know that that's so ignorant, but going my whole life without it and then having it and seeing that contrast, it just never occurred to me. It's like, what? People know that there's God and they just choose not to talk to him. Like, that didn't add up to me. And it's like, wait, I just gave up so much for the Book of Mormon and people just don't read it. Like, it wasn't even a thought. But when I came here and I realized just how complex and difficult it is to grow up in the church, I don't know that I would have been able to do that.
Interesting.
I feel confident that I wouldn't have been able to do that, to not have that contrast, to just have it always there. I would have been the same way. And then I realized, wait, you can go to church every Sunday and not believe any of it. I learned that pretty quick. And so just by observing and listening and being a people watcher, I realized this is so complex. And it's not just me. And so I started the blog is how it all got started.
You
and
started
I started
the blog.
The blog, you know, that Cafe Rio story I wrote about almost 8 years ago. I got over 1 million views in half a day. And I remember thinking, wait, there's something to this. And I remember thinking, it's not because they're also covered in tattoos and that also happened. But I realized if we think that people don't feel the same way we do, well, we're wrong. that's more ignorant than what I was thinking originally. We all feel the same. And so I decided I had to talk about it because I didn't know anyone else at the time who was. And to me, lucky to be a New Yorker, I don't care. I have no shame. I'm really good about being blunt. And that was actually probably one of my best talents is my New Yorker.
Good.
And I started writing and highlighting not my experiences or my story. I never want it to be about my story, but about it's what I felt. Because I want people to see themselves in me in a sense of, wow, I've yelled at God too. It's not just me. People just want to know that they're not alone in their feelings. They want to know, like, I'm not the only one that feels like they don't belong. I'm not the only one that feels like I don't know where God is. Or that I feel like I'm being punished for doing what I thought was the right thing. I want people to know that, hey, it's not just you that wonders where he is and if he cares still about you. And so I started writing that. And so my my first book, Mormon and Patrick Mormon, is essentially, well, like, it's written in a story form, like you'll get the full conversion story, but it is written to those feelings. I wrote it in the sense that I wanted everyone, no matter your age or your gender, or your demographic, like I wanted them to be able to see themselves in me and these experiences and be like, hey, I felt that too. Here's what I learned and here's what I felt and here's what it brought me. So that's the first book.
What year was it published?
2014, 15-ish, 15 maybe.
So that's vaguely my memories. It's been out a few years and I love the cover. I love all these pictures I see of you holding the Book of Mormon and it's just a beautiful picture and it's a beautiful story. Did the book surprise you about how successful it would be?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, we just released a second edition because it did so well. I mean, we added new chapters and gave it a whole revamp because it did so well. Before I even got married, I was already speaking. It was about the time I started the blog that I started speaking. So I probably been about over 8 years, almost 9 years speaking. So they all went hand in hand. People would go and hear me speak and they're like, we want more. So the book was just like a really good thing as a follow-up. And then, that's still doing well and it's been a few years. And then my husband and I wrote about marriage and dating. That's Choose to Eternity. And we wanted people to not tell them this is what you should do or that we're good examples, but helping them create a life to make time for what's important, whatever that is, and to not listen to anyone else's advice and to do the things that you want and feel prompted to do, which is kind of hard to do sometimes. But I'm also, I feel like a pro at that, doing, going against the grain. So that's just encouraging people to make time and to prioritize and to create the life that God intended us to have.
How did you meet Ben?
Huh?
How did you meet Ben?
Oh, he was a missionary in Philadelphia and I was living in Provo and never met him before, but his whole mission added me online because at the time I was doing YouTube videos, just like uplifting
his
church.
His whole mission added you online. I've never heard of such a thing. That's cool.
And so he was piloting Facebook before the church came out. Made that a big announcement. So they all added me on Facebook for my videos, including him. And, we talked about his investigator because he knew I was from the East Coast. We ended up writing each other for about a year and a half, not thinking we'd date. Like, we were pretty bland. I mean, I had a desk job and I was bored, but we talked about the church for about a year and a half and called me right after he gets released and he stuck with me.
Wow. That's really cool. That's a great love story. What a great, unusual way. I've never heard of anybody connecting that way where Ben brought you into his investigator pool to help his investigators find our way in the church, like his whole mission was. But he seemed to, have a real connection with you, and it's cool you wrote. So how long after he got home until you realized this was when you started to date, how long until you realized this is the real deal?
Well, I was going to the temple about 3 times a week then. I was very single. And so I said to him, listen, you can either come with me or don't come with me, but I'm not going to not go to the temple. So he came with me, and within the second week of us knowing each other in person, we were doing sealing. And the sealer stopped in the middle of the ordinance that you guys got to get married. And we're like, what?
Really?
Yeah. And ever since then, I mean, you got to go to that in prayer. Be like, what was that about? And so it actually was a really short time. He got home in February. We got married in August, right? My baptism date. Yeah.
That's great.
I think the sealer jinxed it.
you two just look great together. And when I see you and Ben come up on Facebook and your kids, I just think this is a beautiful couple. You look great together. And I love a lot of these pictures I see with missionaries in your home. It seems like there are missionaries from that mission in New York in your home all the time. And I love the way you tag their parents. And I'm thinking, if I'm a parent and my missionary son just or daughter just got tagged by you, and I'm thinking, this is so cool. I love that part about your ministry.
Yeah, we love missionaries.
So this book, Cheers to Eternity, how long has it been out, Al?
Oh, 2016 or... yeah, 16, I think.
So it's been out a few years.
I don't
know. It's been out a few years, and where can people get that? Amazon?
17. Oh, yeah, Amazon, anywhere... Barnes & Noble, most of them around the West Coast are at Barnes & Noble.
And what kind of feedback have you had from Cheers to Eternity?
Well, we wrote it for people our age, newlyweds or those not yet married. And 90% of the feedback we heard from were people who've been married for 30-plus years. So it's been very surprising.
And what are they saying? I assume they're saying this is helpful for our marriage and just giving us better principles.
Well, yeah, I just think it's the subtle unconsciousness of taking for granted what we have. And that comes in so many layers, in so many ways. So that was good.
I think that's one of the things you have this perspective on is what we take for granted. And one of the themes going through this podcast is interacting with lifelong Mormons, and you're not being critical, but you realize that, and I'm a lifelong Mormon, I don't have the perspective that a convert has about the power of the Book of Mormon, a relationship with God and living among the saints, and just some of the things that I've been taught, having a family that's in the church, and I don't have any of that tension you have with family members that are outside the church. And I think you really bring voice to... what it's like to be on a different road starting out. And it gives you, you're giving perspective to me on some of the things I may have forgotten and take for granted.
Yeah, I just don't know that. That's why I said I just would find it so difficult if I were a born and raised member, because you have that support system. You know, for the most part, you don't go through too many things completely alone. You know, with those things being challenged, because you have friends at church that you can be like, well, what were we taught? What do you know? You know what I mean? I mean, this isn't challenged in the same way as a convert is, who, I mean, really is out there on their own. I mean, I wouldn't have learned 90% of the things that I've learned if my family were members. There's no way.
That's cool. When you said as you were driving to Utah, I'm just imagining you driving in that car you described, and you didn't know why you were going to Utah. Your feeling was you would serve a mission, and then you felt an impression to go to Utah. At what point did you realize why you were in Utah?
Oh, well, I mean, God shows us things every day that we're on the right path. And even now, 9 years later, I'm still seeing things come together where it's like, oh, even today, that wouldn't have happened had I not moved 9 years ago. So, I mean, it's so intricate. We do a really good job at limiting God. We just don't really understand. You know, we give him a nice couple of few adjectives to describe God, but we just don't really give him the credit of his vastness. But I don't know. Good question. I don't know. I'm still piecing things together from that one thing that I did.
Do you think if you had not moved to Utah, you would have become an author in our church and a speaker?
There's no way. I wouldn't have a single thing I have now if it weren't just for that straight out of the gate trial that I had. And, you know, it's so ironic. No matter how real our doubt and our wonders and our questions and our confusion are, no matter how heavy those are, it was every single moment I was screaming at God, wondering where he is and if he cares about me. It was every moment I was wondering where he was that has brought me to everything I have now, and how ironic that is. And that's where I'm trying to be more conscious of allowing myself to let God be God and to embrace the unexpected, knowing who is guiding me. Because, yeah, would I have anything I have now if it weren't for those things? No. There's no way.
That's pretty cool. And I look at, you know, I'm still in the, now I'm in the Cafe Rio line, and you're reading the Book of Mormon, you've got tats, and you get, you know, judged like that, and it feels hurt. And I'm sure at times you wish you didn't have tats, because it would just made your life easier for a period of time. But I'm really glad you have tats, Al. Because of what you've done for our culture, and you've taught me to, when a waiter, a waitress comes to me in the restaurant, I'm 58 in a very conservative culture, white male, I've learned to ask the story behind the tats, or even, you know, I'm not pro tat. I'm not inviting people to get tats, but I do think,
no, don't get them.
But I do think there's a story behind the tats, and I want people to feel at peace with who they are. And so you've helped me to just not see people as do they have tats or not, but see their core goodness and not sort of judge them on some of these things. So it's really helped me. And I think you've helped our culture improve because of using this example of potential judgment. So I'm glad you came to Utah, and I'm glad you wrote this book, because I think it helps us to look inward so we can do better as a culture and better match the gospel of Jesus Christ.
You know, when you feel uncomfortable with yourself, it affects everything. It really does. And if we can learn to figure out and to love who we are and who God sees us, and take confidence and excitement in who we can become, everything else is just noise. And is it because people have stopped being mean or commenting or those laser stares? No, they're still there. Do I care or do I notice them? Well, no. And so it's not that your situation necessarily changes, but you do. Because the reality is, Christ is real. And every passing second is a chance to turn it around. If we just choose him, I don't care how many times a day.
That's cool.
I mean, we think of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Christ loved them. He loves them. You could argue that the three of them are his closest friends, because anytime he was in Jerusalem, he would travel just next door or wherever to Bethany, and he'd stay at their house and sleep over there like that. That's how much he loved them. And then Lazarus gets sick, and he doesn't come. Now, this is hard for Mary, Martha, and Lazarus twofold. One, well, because they know that if he comes, he won't be sick anymore. He can be healed. But also, too, it's hard because he's our friend. He's one of our closest friends. Where is he? Why isn't he here? And he doesn't go. And Lazarus dies. And Lazarus knows he dies, and he doesn't come. And a day passes, and he doesn't come. And 2 and 3 days passes, and he doesn't come. And you can't help but think of Mary and Martha being like, wait, where is he? Why hasn't he showed up yet? If he was here with me, then he could have prevented all of this. And I know that we have these moments in our lives where we're like, wait, why isn't this over yet? Why isn't he here yet? Why didn't he prevent this? He could have stopped this. I thought he loved me. But little do we know, you know, well, culturally, the spirit stays with a deceased body for 3 days. It's not until the 4th day that they're officially dead. And Christ knew this. Had he had come any sooner and healed Lazarus before he even died, or if he would have come even a day sooner, culturally on that 3rd day, all of those Pharisees and great priests that saw him, not even would have not called him rising from the dead a miracle. They wouldn't even dubbed it a miracle at all. They would have said, oh, he wasn't dead yet. So in these times of passing time where we wonder and we doubt and we question and we feel, you know, we anguish, I know that Christ will come with a better and bigger miracle. Like in the scriptures that leave the Pharisees saying, if anyone else sees this and experiences this, everyone will believe. And that's when they start plotting his death.
Yeah.
But I know that that's our reality, that if we hold out, even with the passing time, he will come to us and show us the bigger miracle where we will say there's no reason not to believe him.
I'm just touched by that, Al. I'm touched by that and Christ's relationship with Lazarev and that family and what he knew, the big picture, and he knew the lessons that that would teach, and he loved Lazarev. And I'm so touched by that story because I think at times...
Thanks, I just read it this morning. I just wrote it this morning.
But I think that's a wonderful reason that exists, is why we feel sometimes that God is not there and we don't understand, and we drive to Utah, a place we've never been before, completely across the country, separating yourself from your family and having the courage to act on the impressions of our heart, not knowing necessarily the full story. And God knows the full story. And I love the way you just continually point it back. Your whole podcast so far is pointing everything back to God and Christ. And sometimes you'll say multiple times a day, I need to repoint myself back to God in Christ. And that's just, I'm really struck by how important that is and how impactful that is. But I agree that sometimes those of us that don't have the opposition or grew up in the church, we're not lonely enough sometimes to point ourselves back to Christ, and we can kind of free ride and then we sometimes don't develop the tools needed to be able, because we all eventually will be in a Cafe Rio line or symbolically driving to Utah where we know nobody. We'll all be in those situations, and we need to have the tools to be able to navigate that, because we're meant to be alone at times to struggle through hard things.
I believe that. That's why I love the woman at the well.
Tell us about the woman at the well. I read that on one of your blogs. Tell us why that story.
Well, she went there. I like to picture her sitting there by herself. Who knows what she was thinking about? Maybe she was thinking about the weight of her situation. Maybe she was thinking about how she wishes things were different. Maybe she went there because she wanted to be alone, or maybe she went there because she felt like she deserved to be alone. I don't know. All I know is that Jews do not go to Samaria. They hate Jews. And so not only do Jews have zero reason to go there because they're hated, but there's this straight shot to the Besson Gap to get them where they needed to go. It was fast. Zero reason to go out of your way to a place where you're hated. And Christ does. And he goes to Samaria and he finds the woman at the well. And his disciples, not only are surprised he went that way, but he's surprised that he stops for her, let alone speaks to her. And Christ, not only does he sit and speak, but he stays. And he ends up teaching her and being with her for 2 days straight. And I know that Christ goes metaphorically the long way to get to us in what seems to be like a really difficult moment by yourself with the weight of your problems and this loneliness that you can't seem to figure out or describe to anyone else. That he comes to us and he stays with us and teaches us. And that that could turn into an intimate one-on-one moment with the Savior if, like the woman at the well, we're willing to listen and if we are willing to be taught.
I love that. I love that story. That's a different sort of, that's very helpful. We've got about 10 minutes left. Tell us about your new book, book number 3.
You just heard it. Just kidding. It's called Wildly Optimistic. And the subtitle is Gaining New Perspective for Life's Challenges. I like to consider myself an optimist.
I love it.
But that doesn't mean hard times don't come or that you don't shatter and fall and crumble. But it's that you know something good will come from it. And so Wildly Optimistic, it's 100% about trial. In fact, each chapter is a theme within a trial. So my chapter headlines are when he is silent, when too much time passes, when it's not what we wanted, when we don't fit in. So it's all of the things that I've noticed and gone through. But then the chapter, you know, is God really good? Is he really there for me when he's not answering me? So those are the things that I write about.
That's cool. And I love the way you read about them.
So good.
You read about them authentically, just like you said. It's what you've experienced firsthand.
Yeah. I just think
when do you hope
not
this
enough
book,
people are talking about them.
When do you hope this book will be released? I know I'm probably taking you away from writing right now. Good.
It's coming out this year. It'll be early fall-ish.
Good.
Fall sometime.
Because I do think we need to talk about that. As I met with YSAs when I served in a YSA ward, often they would have those kind of questions, just those very chapter. And I love, and I think real, and so I can give them kind of platitudes, but if I haven't really been in that space sometimes, it's harder for me to give a personal experience. But that's one of the things I love about your story is that you have a personal experience in these spaces. You've had to wrestle really deep with these issues. And I think it's one of the reasons that your voice is so needed and people are looking for, you know, the vulnerability and the insights that you're sharing. We both have a common friend in Dennis Schleicher, who is joined the church on the East Coast. He's gay. He's still gay. He's active in the church, living the church standards. Some people wonder when you get baptized if it changes your sexual orientation. As both of us know, it doesn't. So he's still gay, and that's awesome. But he shared on an earlier podcast, and you know this, that your book was the key to his conversion. Because he, even though he's not, I don't know if he has any tats or not, to be honest, but he identified with you because of your story. And that's one of the things I love about your story is not it has an umbrella to bring everybody in as they're considering the church and use the principles that you taught in that book to help other people. So how did you get connected with Dennis? Did you know that your book was key to his conversion story?
No, I had no idea until his book was already written. and being edited. And I got reached out to, you know, to read it and to be part of it and to write it forward. And that was actually the first time I was even introduced to Dennis. And it wasn't until several weeks ago, you know, we had a phone call, having never met in person still. And I finally heard, like, this is a wild story of the gospel and how this all was intertwined somehow. It's wild.
And Dennis's book is coming out this August.
Yeah.
And tell us the title of the book and say again your foreword and what you kind of give us an overview of your foreword.
Is He Nuts is his book. And it's just one of those things where you should read it. I feel like it's one of those things that we've been talking about where you can see yourself and you have that new perspective to help whatever it is that you're going through too, like in your own personal
yes.
life. And so I think that's why a lot of people compare him to me, or maybe even his book to mine, is because it's like, wait, these are things that people aren't talking about. Wait, I see myself in this. Wait, I like this. This is helping me. This is good. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I've read some of his book. And when I heard you were doing the foreword, I was so grateful because I recognized that will help more people read Dennis's book. And as you know, I've talked a lot about LGBTQ, and I know you're comfortable in that space too, just understanding our LGBTQ members. But I do love Dennis's book, and it humanizes someone that's LGBTQ and can show how our church can work and does work for many LGBTQ people. It's a harder road. They feel probably some of the same cultural judgment or misunderstanding. So it's the mean, I use mean mug as a generic term, you know, and that dear sister in the temple mean mugged my YSA, that sometimes we mean mug people with what we say or how we look. And to your point, often the heart is good for that person, but they just don't have the tools to fully minister and be helpful. So that's
understand. Yeah.
And so that's why you have a lot. That's why I love your book. And I have a question for you. Let's say you know, it's roughly nine years since you were driving that car to Utah. And the first period of time in Utah was hard. If you could talk to yourself, if you could go back and talk to yourself in that Cafe Rio line, now knowing all you know now, what would you say to yourself after that experience in the Cafe Rio line?
Your life turns out awesome. I think about that all the time. I'm an avid journal keeper. Man, yeah, I think back of all of the question marks and the unknowns. And oh man, did I yell at God. Oh, the times I lost my voice. I just tried to shake myself and be like, your life turned out awesome. God is good. He's even better than what you think. And even now, I mean, I'm going through one of, if not the hardest trials of my life right now, currently. Wow. But I still can't help but smile, because we'll have these moments where we stop and we look around and we realize where we are and what we've gained along the way, and we wouldn't want to change a thing.
Will you give some final thoughts for our listeners? What would you say is final thoughts for our listeners?
I hope that we allow ourselves to give God the opportunity to show us how great He really is, because it's real. Our faith and our efforts are not in vain. That blessings do come, and they don't come in order, but they do come if we just continue to choose Him multiple times and to just embrace the unexpected. Pay attention to your reoccurring thoughts, knowing who is guiding you. And every passing second is a chance to turn it all around. And never will God look at you like you're a waste of time. And that He does travel the long way, and He stays with us. because of that compassion he has. That's real.
That's really beautiful.
I mean, hard times will always be there. That won't change. I mean, those weren't the last times I've yelled at God. Hard times will always be there, but so will Christ. And with him, do we overcome and conquer every feeling of loneliness or heartache or temptation? You know, with him, we overcome and conquer the world. And if we think Heavenly Father will do anything to stop us from overcoming and conquering, we're wrong. And if we think Heavenly Father will do anything to stop us from being happy, even in our trials, we're wrong. I mean, comfort is always there because Christ is always there, and he can be felt in the darkest and most confusing of times if you just turn to him and listen and choose to trust.
And listen and choose to trust. We can all do that and turn to him. Al Carraway, thanks for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love. Thanks to your husband, Ben. You two are a great team. You have these two little kids, and I'm just looking forward because some people kind of are able to get their voice in our church and learn that they have a wider role and a greater influence, and that's come for you early. And I'm just looking forward to the next several decades of the good work you will do and your unique role in our church. And I would guess there'll be many, there already are, but there'll be more Dennis Schleichers that are reading or listening to your book on an audio on a long drive and say, this is my church and I can do it, Al, and the Prince. And I love our church. I believe in our church and I believe that it brings people to Christ. And I love what you're doing in our church to help others. So I send you all of our listeners send you our love and support, that you will continue to feel sustained in your unique life mission. And we're excited to see this third book. Does the third book have a name yet, Al?
Wildly Optimistic.
That's right. You said that. Wildly Optimistic. And, you know, people can Google Al Carraway. She has a website, alcarraway.com, where I was just looking at many of the blogs that you've done. And it's a listing, and Al also speaks. So I think you're booked up already for 2019. But if people would like Al to come speak at a stake or kind of a larger event, she's willing to do that. And there's a form to fill out. But doesn't surprise me, you're already booked for 2019. And, and you have a life, you have a husband and kids. So I think you're doing a good job of managing all that. And anyway, thank you, Al, and all of our listeners for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler.